Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Ian Kellett. How are you, Ian?
I'm fine, Chris. Good
Excellent.
To see you.
If I said Kellett right, it's K-E-L-L-E-T-T. It's more.
That's absolutely more, right.
It's quite an efficient last name. It's only got four different letters in it. No, one, two, three, four, five. Five different
I think
letters.
It was Celtic.
Celtic, originally.
Originally.
So does that make you Scottish or no, Welsh?
I'm a Yorkshireman born and bred.
Yorkshire.
But I got sent south when I was a boy.
Not really talking about taking coals to Newcastle. We're talking about taking sparkling wines to the English trade tasting, or at least your wines anyway. You're the owner or majority shareholder in Hambledon Vineyards, which where are they based?
We're at Hambledon in Hampshire, which is between Winchester and Petersfield, about 6 miles north of the south coast.
No, I'm not very good at geography.
So if you take the south coast and you go the south coast near sort of Portsmouth and Fareham, and you go miles north,
okay,
we're around about there.
Oh, Winchester ways.
Between Petersfield and Winchester. Yeah.
I don't know Petersfield. I know where Winchester is. So, okay, I got some friends down there.
And we're on the chalk.
Oh, you are on the chalk.
We're
are
on
you?
The chalky downs of southern England.
Okay, a lot of people aren't, you know.
No, there are a lot of people. They're making
still nice wines.
They are.
I don't know. I think sometimes maybe that English chalk is a bit overdone a bit. Everybody's like quite excited about being on it. You know, same chalk or similar chalk as Champagne, but there's some nice wines that are being made that aren't on chalk.
I think for the Chardonnay grape, that chalk will prove to be quite characteristic for winemaking, full stop, for growing vines, full stop. Chalk has a remarkable set of properties. A cubic meter of chalk will hold 660 litres of water, but it also drains well.
Yeah.
And that's a bit technical and boring, but what it means is the vines will never dehydrate in a hot summer like 2003. So in 2003, the Champagne vineyard was green right the way through, whereas if you went to Bordeaux, you had seriously difficult problems.
Yep.
So if you're on chalk, your vines are always going to be well enough watered without being overwatered. So that's true for all the vines, but I think for Chardonnay specifically, some of the minerality and some of the classic characteristics we're looking for in Chardonnay base wines for sparkling wine and for Blanc de Blanc in particular, the chalk will show through.
Oh, well, I think it's still quite early days really for that sort of stuff, isn't it? Although maybe
it all remains to be seen, but Côte de Blanc in Champagne, where they grow their Chardonnay, is about 6 inches of soil at most, and then it's solid bedrock chalk. And that's exactly what we're on in Hambledon in Hampshire.
Is it mainly Chardonnay you've planted?
We've planted about 65% Chardonnay on the estate so far, and then about half the other two varieties, Pinot Meunier and Pinot Noir. It varies a bit by location, so there are some locations that we think are going to be better suited for Pinot Noir and some for Pinot Meunier, but the body of the vines that we've planted is Chardonnay.
Okay, and do you like Chardonnay, or is...
I think that as a Blanc de Blanc sparkling wine, I think that's what England's going to actually produce best over decades to come. I think it will be the characteristic English wine of the future.
And when did you plant your Chardonnays?
So in 2005, I rather savagely ripped out some of the oldest vines in England and replanted with Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier.
I was going to say that because the vines were originally planted in the 50s, weren't they?
Yeah, so in 1951, too, Major General Sir Guy Salisbury-Jones planted England's first commercial vineyard, really since the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII. And he was a friend of Odette Paul Roget, so the Paul Roget family sent over their vineyard supervisor to help with the planting. And there's been an association between Hambledon and Paul Roget going back those 50 or 60 years. And when I bought the place in 1999, I did a bit of studying of what the strategy should be, and then went back to Hugh Bedderby at Paul Roget for some advice and guidance. He introduced us to our winemaker, who's the former chef de cave of Du Valois. And so we're really trying to take the benefit of Champagne's several hundred years of experience and apply it on the same chalk over here.
Okay. And did you leave any of the original grapes in place?
Sadly not. Well, that's not true. We've probably got about 5 plants left.
Okay. What were they planted?
Back in the 50s, you mean?
Yeah.
So they were planting Sauval Blanc, some Chardonnay and some Pinot Meunier, but a range of varieties, but mostly to make the kinds of still table wines that were consumed in England at the time.
What's that, medium, sweet?
At the time, you know, we're talking the 1950s, so So insofar as there was a mass wine market in the UK, which there broadly wasn't, you know, the main brands were the ones we all know, of Blue Nun and Black Tower and all of that sort of thing. So that was perceived to be the market that needed to be satisfied. And so the varieties that were planted with a view to trying to sell into that market, which is rather different to looking at the terroir and saying, what can it grow?
Yeah, okay. And so that was all planted. And then when you bought the vineyard in 1990s, you said?
I bought the vineyard in 99. Mm-hmm. There'd been two changes of ownership between Guy Salisbury Jones and me buying it. Mm-hmm. And when I bought it, my predecessor had run down the winemaking at the site in the previous 4 years, but we were still growing vines. So vines have been commercially grown right the way through from 51 to the current day.
Okay, so he wasn't making his own wines?
He wasn't making his own wines, no. And was selling the grape away.
And was Hambledon, was it named Hambledon Vineyards back then?
Yeah. So there was a company called Hambledon Vineyards Limited through the 70s and the 80s. There were 10,000 visitors a year to the site in the 1970s. First ever opened air at an English vineyard in 1955, organised by the Red Cross. And we have lovely, lovely photographs going back to those days. And there's a lovely, actually, if you go onto British Pathé, as in Pathé Films, there's a lovely, and type in English vineyard, there's a lovely clip from the 1960s of a harvest with a classically English voiceover of the time. It's very cute. People picking grapes in ties and jackets.
Oh, really? Yeah, fantastic.
Very, very English.
You know, in the old days, people used to go out to the country for the harvest, didn't they? You know, a lot of people from London as well, a lot of the workers.
Well, I think in the old days, harvests of different crops, that's true. But I think in the old days, there weren't many harvests of vines being had.
Yeah.
When people used to come out from London. So so they were picking hops and whatever down in Kent. But they weren't coming out from town to pick grapes very much.
So what got you into the wine trade there, Ian?
So I've been in the food and drink industry for 30 years.
What were you doing before that?
So I was running food companies and then went to the city to work for Kleinwort Benson, one of the investment banks, working on food companies like Nestle and drinks companies like Diageo and the champagne businesses, advising investors where to put their money. Mm-hmm. And then as a bit of a sort of poacher turned gamekeeper, I decided to invest my own money into a vineyard and restoring England's oldest vineyard to a hopefully in the future preeminent position in the centre of the English sparkling wine industry is a sort of core tenet of our strategy, really.
Okay. All right. Well, it's quite nice that it's still going, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we're doing our best.
What wines are you focusing on?
So we intend to have two brands, one of which will be called Milldown. And Milldown...
Sounds a bit close to mildew.
It does sound close to mildew. It's got two L's in it.
Though. Yeah.
Windmilldown is the the house, the plant, is the hill that the vines are planted on in front of the house.
Yep.
And so, and there was a windmill behind the house till about 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's a lovely angled footpath that heads up from the village to the site of the former windmill. So you can imagine all these people carrying their sacks of wheat up the hill for milling. So Milldown will be our second wine. It's an annual vintage release in the way that much of the English sparkling wines are. And under the Milldown brand, we will probably end up in due course. At the moment, we've got a classic cuvee, but in due course, we will probably end up doing the range of pink sparkling wines and Blanc de Noir.
Yep.
Above Milldown, we'll have the Hambledon brand. That will be our main brand. And that will be a non-vintage, multi-year blended cuvee. Mm-hmm. It's in a non-standard champagne bottle. And really, we're trying to push the product, depending on the quality of the wine that comes through, we're trying to push the product to being England's sort of first prestige cuvee. So the bottle shape is remarkably similar.
As a non-vintage, though. So.
As a non-vintage. And there are some other non-vintage cuvees in non-standard bottle shapes that are, you know, some of the world's most famous. And if you look at the way in which we've designed our brand, then it might resonate.
All I'm going to say is, for someone who opens a lot of wines and has to lug bottles around, non-standard shapes,
yep.
Pain in the ass, to be honest.
Sure, but people manage to sell Krug 500,000 bottles a year, even though it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Okay, and it's quite unusual, though. Well, not unusual, but there does seem to be a move where the non-vintages are almost more premium than the vintages, whereas in Champagne it's the other way around. A lot of English producers always produce a vintage, but not many produce non-vintage. And you're trying to position your non-vintage as more high-end.
So what that means will happen over time is that our non-vintage will periodically, much as the Champagne non-vintages do, will periodically, in really good years, release a vintage. Mm-hmm. Whereas what's happening with English sparkling wine is they release a vintage every year.
Yep.
So our Hambledon brand will behave much more like a premium or even super premium Champagne brand. Once every 5 or 10 years, when it's really worth doing, will release a vintage. But for most of the time, it will be a non-vintage wine that's aiming to take out the worst of the peaks and troughs of harvest.
Yep.
By blending across multiple years and with multiple wine making techniques.
Okay. And then the Mildown will be a... Is that a vintage every year?
It will be a vintage every year in the way that the English sparkling wines classically are.
That is something that does seem to be coming out in England, isn't it? That it is more vintage orientated.
Yep.
Even at the entry levels.
Yep.
Whereas in Champagne, it's non-vintage. I've always thought that was more of a... just a lack of wine, really. They weren't holding anything back because they just needed to get out the door, but...
I think that there's some truth in that, probably, but obviously better to speak to them about it rather than us.
Okay. And you're a limited liability company, and you're the
We're
main...
We're a PLC.
PLC, yeah.
We're a PLC. Public limited company. We're not listed,
yeah.
But we do have external shareholders. We've got 42 shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
We have something over 60% of the shares. And we have some very supportive shareholders who, when you think about it, have put money into this business without it selling anything for the first 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
So they're really, some of them are backing it with their passion and some of them are backing it with their brains, and we hope to deliver well for both of them financially and in terms of the quality of wine that we make, so they can be proud of it, really.
Yeah, 2012 was always going to be a crunch year for English wine because it must have been about 2008, a lot of vines went in the ground, and 2012 was the year that they were all coming good. And I was never worried because the Olympics, I thought, you know, that'll be fine, but there doesn't seem to be too many problems with it. You know, the main thing I've seen recently is English wine producers, the trade body, was at Pro Wine this year, trying to dig up some exports. But there doesn't seem to be an oversupply of wines at the moment.
So the world sparkling wine market is about 2.3 billion bottles. Champagne makes about 335 million of them. England currently makes, pick a number, 2 million, and when all that vine that's planted comes through, it might be making, nobody really knows, but say 5 million out of 2.3 billion.
Yeah.
I really don't understand what the panic's all about. And the UK market's 100 million bottles for sparkling wine and been growing at 10% compound for 20 years. That's not to say every year's a 10% year, but that's the average. And so if England is genuinely making already the second best quality in aggregate of sparkling wine in the world, which a lot of people in the room today would accept as true, and there are those wines who will aspire to do better than second place behind Champagne, then what market share of our own domestic market should we have?
Mm-hmm.
Should we have a 10% market share? Should we have a 20% market share? They're not the wrong numbers. So that means we should be doing 10 or 20 million bottles, or maybe 30 or 40 million bottles, especially with future growth in consumption.
Yep.
And that's just for the domestic market.
Yeah.
And there's a 1.8 billion bottle export market to go after, excluding Champagne. So to my mind, the worries about overplanting are overplayed. It's about what's really important. If you look at the Champagne market, we all see Champagnes that are sold at £10 a bottle in Majestic and Sainsbury and wherever. And so we all get terrified about that. But equally, we see wines that are sold at £230 a bottle. So you'll find that we'll end up with exactly the same here. It won't be generic. Everybody's trying to cluster in the £20 a bottle range. And there'll be some that end up falling out, and they'll be 10 quid a bottle. And there'll be some that end up doing really well with their brands and their wine quality, and they're not necessarily the same thing. And they'll be selling for 50, 60, 70, 80 pounds a bottle.
Yeah.
And there'll be a whole range.
Do you think, what sort of investment have you put in? You said you've got external shareholders now to give some funds. Where are you putting that money?
Altogether, over 10 years, over 10 years altogether, we'll have spent anything up to £10 million before we sell a single bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
So if people wonder why English sparkling wine is perceived as expensive, you know, you try putting £10 million down for 10 years and not getting a penny back.
Yeah.
And I think, just to develop that a bit, if you compare that to the cheap champagnes, a lot of those champagnes, you know, it was their granddaddy who planted the vineyard.
Yep.
And it was their granddaddy who built the winery. And that's all, that money's all in the past. And those people just need to pay themselves a reasonable and decent and good living, but they don't need to pay back millions and millions of pounds of investment. Clearly, for England starting a wine industry, it's a remarkably different proposition. There are, and there's probably orders of magnitude, there's probably about £100 million, my guess. I need to think about it a bit more, but between 50 and 100 million, certainly, of capital that's gone into the English wine industry in the last 10 years. And that money needs to, in order to attract that money to go in order to grow the kind of volume that we need to grow to be taken seriously in the world, instead of making a good quality product with a teaspoonful of volume so that nobody in the world can drink it, we know we need to develop a proper industry. And
yep.
That needs capital to be invested, and that needs returns to be generated.
What about non-sparkling wines?
We don't make any.
Yeah, and that was because?
That was because we looked at the climate presently in England, and we looked at the potential alcohol that was typically being generated on grapes that were being grown, and it depends on variety and location. And we concluded that taking a process whereby you had a second fermentation in the bottle in order to boost alcohol level to a reasonably consistent level, plus if you're investing quite substantial amounts of money to make a reasonably scaled business, you can sell sparkling wines for £20 a bottle, say, and you can still sell still wines for, you know, you pick your number, but a lower number.
Yep.
To me, the maths and the strategy is not hard. But apart from the finances of it, it's also about what do I think this country can best produce. To me, what was really important was when I drank the wines that Hambledon was making before I arrived, I had to form a view of whether I could drink them and whether I could serve them to family and guests in my own home, first and foremost, and then whether I could then sell them. And, you know, maybe that's why I chose to replant to something that I think I am happy drinking myself and giving to my family and friends with pride. Not pride in a nasty way, but pride in a nice, gentle, warm way, and therefore to have confidence selling it out to other people and feeling good about doing it.
Did you completely replant, like rip everything out, or did you graft, or what did you do?
The whole thing.
Just pulled it all out.
We kept five vines.
Five vines. Why the five vines?
Because they were strategically located in a way that it was easy for us to keep them. And also we kept the oldest and largest vine on the site. It has a trunk circumference of probably, I don't know what that is, 30 centimetres, something like that.
15, 20 centimetres diameter.
Yeah, it's a chunky old vine. So we kept that one and probably half a dozen others. But yeah, essentially we replanted the vineyard.
Okay, and that's to go down the sparkling route?
That's to go down the sparkling route.
But
grapes were grown in the year preceding planting, and then vines were replanted and grown in the following year. So what's important to us is that commercial vine growing has been going on at the site every year since 1951.
Yep. Okay then, Ian. Well, it's good to see that a vineyard is continuing, even if it's now being adapted to modern English winemaking techniques or modern English winemaking. We'll wrap it up there, Ian. Thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Cheers, bud.